Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter at securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress. One bank that can make so much of an impact, I mean, I guess it tells you a lot about the bank because its ability to help bring a whole bunch of companies to market, but it also tells you something that a lot of people had a lot of eggs in one basket. And to make Friday be the kind of day that it was for so many companies really says a lot about, you know, I guess it got me thinking about risk. It got me thinking about not financial risk, but that's the obvious part, but just how some of that translates into security risk. And it made me, you know, it started a lot of things. It started a lot of discussions about, you know, fraud. Everyone needs to change their banking accounts. Everyone, you know, that got me thinking about, you know, do we have all of our tools in one? You know, do we have too much consolidation? I know I spent a lot of time about consolidation. It also got me thinking about now what happens to if half of our vendors disappear because, you know, we're using a lot of security world as startups or smaller companies. So yeah, it's just been a nerve wracking 48 hours now when we're recording this. So, you know, 72 hours when hopefully tomorrow I can have this edited and out. So I guess, Brian, I think you had shared a really good synopsis of what happened and how. Just for those who, you know, the other shocking part to me is there are those people who saw this on the news and it was completely orthogonal to their life. Like, their Friday was no different. It was a news story. You know, for me, it was quite a heavy news story and quite impactful. But can you give just a synopsis?
Yeah, so kind of high overview, Silicon Valley Bank, like any other bank, has money coming into it where, and I think the number there, and I could pull it up, was, you know, over $250 billion in what you could roughly call assets, right, in dollar amount. And when you look at where Silicon Valley Bank is located in the history of it.
Is it in Silicon Valley?
What's that?
Where it's located. Yeah. Is it in Silicon Valley?
Yeah. So that, for one, where it's located, two, even the name itself, Silicon Valley Bank, and who they work with, has a deep history of working with, whether it's venture capital, whether it's tech startup, which includes security startup companies, but working with technology companies, and has been very pivotal in the area over the years of working with startups, right? Because they know who the venture capital arms are that are bringing money in, right? To infuse money. And when that money gets infused into a startup, that startup was banking with Silicon Valley Bank. The last 3 years, or I shouldn't say last 3 years, if you go back to 2018, 19, 20, 21, great time to be investing in startups, right? You look at the valuations, the companies that were going public. The one that I worked for prior was considered the largest cybersecurity IPO in history, right? And at one point in like 3 months, it was up to almost $78 a share from when it IPO'd. They're all the way down at $14. So you look at the loss in valuation over 2022. So what ended up happening at Silicon Valley Bank, they had all this money coming in because everybody was dumping into startups, especially cybersecurity startups. It was like, you just couldn't lose, right? You know, put that in the little air quotes there, just couldn't lose. But what ended up happening then in 2022, as money began to get tighter, you had less money coming in, but these startups are burning through their cash. So they're starting to pull money out, whether it's for payroll, other investments, et cetera. And they're trying to get more venture capital money, but the VCs were being a little more stringent on A, what they want in return, and B, who they were going to give it to. So what did this mean for Silicon Valley Bank? You had this huge amount of money over the span of X number of years coming in. But in 2022, you don't have as much money coming in and more going out. Silicon Valley Bank had invested, though, taken that money, right? I think the number is, and I'll have to go back and pull this up, but you have to keep 10%, right, on hand at all times of, say, cash or asset in terms of what you're loaning out or using. And Silicon Valley Bank had leveraged that money in long-term bonds and other investments, which had a very slow or sometimes almost minute percent increase over a period of time. So you look at the money that had gone out that was sitting, they're not getting enough brought back in return and in their investments, and people are pulling money out. They looked at that and the balance sheet was looking very dire. So they decided they were going to do a raise, try to raise some capital to get through this hard time. But because their communication was pretty lackluster in why they were doing the raise and not telling the people that banked with them what this meant, they just figured they'd do a raise. The second they did that, that's when the snowball effect occurred. And I don't have the dates put in front of me and the exact time they did it, but that was in the last month they decided they were going to do that raise. Then they went to go do it. The second people found out about that, everybody panicked and said, they're trying to raise money. This is a bad sign. We need to get our money out. People couldn't get their money out fast enough. And when that happened and there was a run on the bank, they immediately became insolvent. And that's when, you know, the federal government stepped in. But this is, and I'm reading an interesting book here. Timing's everything, right? It's called All the Devils Are Here. And this goes back to the mortgage crisis and so forth. And you look at Sallie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they were like, they somewhat told everybody, like, all this stuff is, we're the only, you know, mortgage lenders, et cetera, that can be federally insured or federally backed, right? Or protected. And at the end of the day, they were not. But you look at, when you say all the eggs in one basket, you go back to Silicon Valley Bank here, because of their long history, because everybody, in the venture capital world and the startup world, everyone loved doing business with them because they were also able to connect the dots between, you know, the right venture capital firms, the tech startup world. They knew who the players were. Everybody, it was kind of like that, we've been in this a long time together. And the second there was a run on it, there was no stopping it.
So yeah, and I think to double click on part of that as well, you know, granted, I'll throw this out there, I am not a finance or accounting guy, so this is just my interpretation of some of the elements that I read, that the way they do their securities, that they have two classes of securities, right? That you have HTM, which is the held to maturity, and then you have available for sale. So think of it as long-term, short-term. And what happened with the long-term securities, that in the good times they ballooned, the value was worth way more than they bought them for. But in the bad times, they had dropped under the valuation. Now, my understanding of HTMs is you do not have to show those in your financials. And the thinking there is that because we already know what they are at maturity, that the spikes and the dips don't really matter. So this almost goes back, and then I'll pass it back to Brian, because this is almost like what we've talked about in the past about TPS and Toyota Production System and Taichi Ono's view of inventory sitting on the shop floor, right? That as you raise the tide, that you forget about all of these rocks. It doesn't force you to deal with all the rocks that are underneath it. And that's exactly what happened in this case, that these maturities were underwater, weren't worth very much. And then you infuse what Brian was saying about the run on the bank, that we're trying to pull capital out. And there was not enough money in the bank to actually hand that out. So they had to start short sailing these securities, which then kind of triggered that, hey, we need an influx of capital, and just created that snowball and essentially created fear, and everybody just, it created a run on the bank.
Hey, I love your comparison to Taichi Ono, because exactly that, if you start to pull out everything you built, but you don't have anything back there to build more,
right?
You just depleted everything, that all your inventory. And I threw something up in there where I wrote, at the end of 2022, Silicon Valley Bank held $117 billion of securities, which accounted for the bulk of its 200 plus billion in assets. These bonds were showing big losses at the end of 2022, with some 91 billion of the bond portfolio classified as held to maturity securities for accounting purposes, worth just 76 billion. So if you had to hold that, right, like they were just in a very bad situation.
And people ask the
question. That is normal activity for a bank.
Yeah.
And people ask the question, you know, why are bonds are sure things? Why are they going down? The one thing to remember is that as interest rates rise, bond yields go down. So as we've seen interest rates rise, which, you know, when you're in your checking and savings account, you're finally earning more than 0.000001. You're seeing mortgage rates go up, but you're also going to see bond yields go down as a result of it, which is what led to this reduction in value. So now that we've finished business school 101 here.
If, and I'm trying to pull the numbers here, but 89% of the bank's $175 billion in deposits were uninsured as of the end of 2022.
Yeah.
And their fate remains to be determined.
And why is it uninsured? It's uninsured because FDIC only lets you hold $250,000 per account that are insured by the federal government. Now, something else that needs to be kept in mind, this isn't all doom and gloom. At this moment, as of Sunday morning, the 12th of March, the expectation is that the uninsured portions will be funded based on the sale of the rest of the bank's assets. So they're trying to sell the bank and it's, you know, all the assets within it to somebody else. Once that happens, then the current holders of the of accounts should be able to get at some, if not all, of the uninsured money. Again, depending on how much those assets are sold for and what the difference is. So there's, you know, I think the first risk question that comes to mind is, it's the insurance question. You know, are you holding enough insurance to cover the assets that you have? And then, you know, we'll take that from banking and move it into security and say, are we, you know, we have insurance, either liquid, either capital in our own banks to cover our, you know, to cover losses from a security breach, from a data breach, or from just a general attack or outage. We also have, you know, outside insurance that we buy and hope is not excluded when the time comes. But how accurately are we evaluating how much of that insurance, will really cover in the course of a real issue or attack?
It's a great, great question. And it'll be interesting to see what the Fed does, what federally insured. And I'm not pivoting here, Dan, but I had seen somebody had posted some information from Dmitry Alperovich, who had put a tweet together with like six or seven items. The first item being, one, payroll was being processed on Friday, also hearing that the FDIC explicitly plans to allow it to continue to go through, assuming funds are available in the account. So they're trying to ensure that payroll is happening, right? The point three that they made was there's a good chance that wires placed before a certain cutoff time on Friday that got stopped by the feds will clear by Monday, right? I hadn't heard that before. And then it went on to talk about lots of options are available from your venture investors, private credit firms, and others to get short-term credit if need be. And the FDIC receivership certificates you will get next week can be used as collateral as well. And then one of the points he makes is don't put all your eggs in one basket going forward. Diversify your banking options. Don't rely on one, no matter how big. And that goes back to what some of the things we just talk about in security in general, about putting all your eggs in one basket while you have defense in depth, et cetera. My brother used to say it all the time in terms of banking. He goes, I can remember being in the car with him and his son was about six or seven at the time. And he said, you know, son, why do we use more than one bank? And his son goes, because we don't put all our eggs in one basket. We have to make sure to protect ourselves, right? And it's because my brother used to repeat that so often. And when this happened, like I immediately thought back to that car ride sitting there with him, of why my brother banks with several different banks. You're only insured up to that 250,000 point, right? What does this mean for the security world? Over 80% of the tech companies out there supposedly used Silicon Valley Bank for at least one of their accounts, right? There's some out there that talked about, you know, they banked with five or six different banks, but they held the majority at SVB because they liked working with them, the history of SVB. And frankly, they're like, they thought it was their safest bet.
Yeah, and it's that didn't work. Yeah, and it's, yeah, it's funny because there was also cases where that's where they kept their liquid capital. There were also cases where loans you had or lines of credit that were extended by Silicon Valley Bank were also tied to holding liquid assets there. So there were some also some strange or not usual banking arrangements that you know, that resulted as well. But the, you know, the question is, as I'm hearing you talk and I'm trying to put myself in our listeners' shoes, is okay, it's a bank, it wasn't hacked, it's just money. Why does any of this affect my real life? Like on Monday, what changes? Well, and so I guess I want to talk a little bit about that, because there's a few things you can expect. One, you're going to get a lot of, or you may get, you know, inquiries or notices from those companies saying, hey, we have new banking details, we have new checking accounts for you to pay us. And I don't know about you, but I've gotten those regularly, both real and fraudulent. So it's a great reminder to parse those, to reach out to the actual company itself when you get those, not the number, not the phone number on the notice, not the email address on the notice, and confirm that this is actually the case. Also check, look for routing numbers. I'll see if I can find it again. Someone had posted the actual routing numbers, the ABA numbers for Silicon Valley Bank. So if you weren't already paying to a Silicon Valley Bank, you may want to double check those before routing, because it may be fraudulent. You know, we always think about the cynical things, right? It's all going to go as planned. So there's that. But the other is, you know, the net of this is today, Sunday, as we go into a new work week, smaller companies, and even bigger companies now may not have access to money to pay their people, pay their AWS bills, to pay their, you know, anything. So services may not be able to continue. I've heard, you know, discussions over the weekend about companies being graceful, giving grace when it comes to turning off services and things like that as a result of it. But I saw, you know, there's companies that now have, if they don't get access to their funds, have $0. I was talking to one friend who had just taken a few million dollars in new investment, and it landed there earlier in the week, and he had not yet had time to get it out or to spread it around the banks, and it's gone. That was their entire operating capital. So it's held, not gone. So on Monday, you know, the idea is they're going to start paying out of their own pocket to keep things going. So you may see vendors disappear on Monday. I don't think it's going to be quite that dire, but there are vendors who just don't have access to their money. And as we all know, money makes the world go round. So, you know, look for that as well. Look for, be ready to respond quickly when services either stop working, reduce working, customer support is hard to get a hold of. I mean, there may very well be, at the more extreme, companies that just close. The net of this over the long term is we are going to see companies, if they don't get money back, I think Roku, you know, Roku, I think, is an extreme example, because they have a fair bit of money. 25% of their entire net worth was in Silicon Valley Bank. So if for some reason that cash doesn't come back, that's 25%. But put that on a smaller case and you have companies who had, you know, $2 million in the bank and some runway. They now have zero. If that doesn't return, that company doesn't return without some kind of significant help.
And one thing I was going to say there, and I'd love to hear Eric's point on this too, is, Dan, you were saying, you know, we need to be cautious. We need to be talking to our finance teams to say, hey, there's going to be possible several different vendors reaching out, changing their routing information, their payment information, their invoice information of who they're doing business with. You know, we need to call and confirm. Imagine the number of companies that are going to have changes. And when you said, like, you may call or you may reach out, but you get a busy signal. If they have 500 customers, 1,000 customers, some of these have 2,000 customers, and you're changing routing and billing information, imagine the phone calls that are coming in if they had to reach out to every one of their customers, and now all those customers are reaching out to confirm.
So are you recommending not to confirm then, or just patient? Or?
I'm recommending patience. I'm recommending confirm. I'm recommending you don't use the email that you received with the phone number on it. I recommend you go back and find who your contact is, which is going to take some time. What I fear is if someone gets, and think about all the vendors they do business with, if someone got 50 new routing emails from 50 vendors and has to call every single one of them, to them, that's painful. By the time they get to the 10th one and they open it up, they may just happen to call the phone number right there. And now they're talking to Mr. Threat Actor, who's like, yeah, no, that's correct. Yeah, because of Silicon Valley Bank, blah, 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 blah. And imagine the use, like, this one scares me, right, on that point alone. So,
yeah, this one's not about data as much as it is about money.
Money, straight fraud. And we all know that, you know, by the end of 2022, the biggest impact from cybersecurity wasn't ransomware. It was actual email compromise fraud.
Right.
It had actually surpassed it. And Eric, are you there?
I'm here.
What are your thoughts? You said you hadn't seen anything as of Friday, but come Monday of next week, as that week progresses, what's the message that you're sending, double checking? And then I also want to ask in that same breath, when you look at the number of companies, I think it said in 2022, over 50% of the companies that IPO'd were banking with Silicon Valley Bank. I can tell you from my time at Sentinel One, when before we were public, people would ask, that was one of the things we had to present on. What round of funding are you at? What's your road to profitability? There was all these things. And I was like, what's the worry? You know, like money's coming. Everyone wants to throw us money, right? Like I didn't say that ever in a meeting, but that was the feeling, like, wow, I was really surprised. But by my second or third year there, nobody was really worried about that. It was like, oh, you guys are CD round. Oh, you guys plan to IPO? Of course you do, right? Like that was like the confidence in the market that you're talking to said customer. How does that change your perspective now because of what just happened, right? And go ahead.
Yeah, so part one of the question. No, so I think this is an opportunity to take a step back and as you guys were talking about, look at the controls that are already in place from a financial perspective on those changes. Right. A lot of organizations, unfortunately, still don't have good controls around this. And a lot of times, you know, I know we've talked about this before as technologists, that we tend to gravitate towards, well, we need a technical control to combat BECs, business email compromises. The best control here is non-technical. And I think, Dan, you put it, pick up the phone. Yeah. And that's like the process we built out. And this has always been our longstanding process, is that we will not key off of anything that comes in an email. We have a customer record that has all of the contact information. We have to go back to that customer record. And that's how we're reaching out to verify the information is good. So build those non-technical controls. But to the second part of the question and how that changes our look at some of these companies, you know, taking this tangentially and kind of taking a step back, that this yet again highlights the same thread of a Kronos, of a Colonial Pipeline, of these other things that we look at these, in this case, it would have been kind of GAAP financial statements and everything that they were producing to say, all right, they're looking good, right? All of the numbers jive, but it misses the underlying risk that's boiling in kind of the exposure that they had. It's really no different from my perspective than what we see for companies that I'm ISO 27001 certified. I have this certification that at a high level, they look great, but it's not actually showing the actual risk underneath and how they may have crumbling controls. And this is why on our side of the fence, the SEC is looking at those controls that, hey, we want you to be more transparent on the controls that you have in place and anything that could have material impact to a shareholder. And I would expect then this is going to create another opportunity on the banking side that they're going to find some metric, some way. So the hold to maturity, I would imagine that we're going to see a change there, that the change in value there has to be disclosed as the coupling of two events as they draw down on the valuation of the HTMs, coupled with organizations that have money in that bank that may need it out because of either risk or liquidity, whatever it is, that the combination of those two obviously creates a very bad scenario. So I think this is another opportunity that we need to take a look at. How can we create better transparency around the risk underneath some of the frameworks and stuff that we have today to show or to give kind of transparency and comfort to organizations that are doing business with others?
Hey, I have a question on, I talk a lot about suites versus best of breed, and some of the, I guess, some of the risks and positives of putting all your eggs back into one basket from a security controls perspective. But juxtaposing that against what I also talk about a lot, which is getting back to basics and fundamentals and taking other tools out of our security stack. And as I sit and think about where we are right now, where we're, you know, as we're sitting looking at potentially vendors in the security space disappearing. Now, again, this is all conjecture. This is all what if, because, you know, we're in information security. It's always about planning for the worst case and then, you know, executing on the thing that happens on this side of that. What happens if three of our vendors in our security stack disappear this week because of it? Or even worse, that the suite vendor that we had that takes care of the whole security stack or a large part of it disappears as a result of it. Does this change either of your thinking on A, reducing the number of tools, because that's been a huge focus, at least for me of late, not overbuying on, you know, the new whiz bang security tool, because there's a lot of them, and we're not always using the basics the full way, or keep or diversifying your vendors so that any one, you're not putting your risk in any one of them disappearing and, you know, taking down a huge part of your security environment.
It's complicated.
Well, it depends. We don't ask simple questions here.
No, it's interesting because from my perspective, I mean, so throwing this out there first, number one, you never get to a point where you have no risk, right? I think we can all accept that. But at some point, there's an inflection point. There's a point of diminishing returns. You can only go so far down the rabbit hole to try to protect against what ifs. So I think you've got to be careful in that sense. But I think by and large that we've been consistent, at least the three of us, that the idea of consolidating everything onto one single platform, probably Microsoft, not the best idea. Now, as you start getting into some of your SMB space, some of your smaller companies that, okay, I get it, the financials, the operability of it, some of that stuff makes sense. But I go back to what Brian was saying about, I think some of this comes with defense in depth. And as you're thinking through your control stack, that there, you know, a lot of, as I look at a lot of our vendor base, there is, think of it more as a Venn diagram as opposed to verticals, right? There's a lot of the tools as they continue to expand more and more that there's overlap in some of the capabilities. And I think that's actually a really good thing to have. So in the event some of these companies go belly up, that you've got coverage until you can get something net new in. But I'll say, I don't think this is anything different, Dan, because I think we've looked at some of these, as you're talking about the whiz bang or the new organizations that are coming up that you want to partner with. We've always had the risk in the back of our mind. Well, what happens if they get acquired? What happens if they get acquired, that investment stops going into them, or they just completely go a different direction? They get bought up to get shut down. That risk has always existed. This is just a different lens in how we're looking at it. I don't think a whole heck of a lot changes.
And it does, and it has existed, but at a scale. Now, let's say there's 10 of them that all go away at the same time. Now, you know, we've always thought about it as, well, what if whiz bang vendor one goes away. We're not also generally thinking about it as 1, 2, 3, 6, 10, and 14 all go away at the exact same time or within a week of each other.
Hey, backing up just a hair here in the conversation. So if, let's say you had three or four that you were using for a specific stack and they all went away, I'd say you have a lot to deal with. But going back to the root of the problem, why they're going away, right? In SVB, and it's insolvency, right? And how did this happen? When you go back and look at some pretty intelligent mathematicians that came up with different algorithms and ways to calculate what one day of risk looks like, right? What is the biggest risk we could take in a single day, but not put the company in disrepair, right? And you hired some very intelligent people to go through tons of different modeling to see what that looks like. And if you go back in the history of like how default swaps and everything were created, right? Well, we needed more assets, right? To be able to lend more money and loan more money. And part of the mechanism of the default swaps was these mortgage loans were then assets. If you go into SVB, the companies they primarily were dealing with were startups. It was SVB that was not diversified. They had all, like people say, well, everyone had all their eggs in one basket being SVB. Well, SVB had all their eggs in one basket, that being tech, right? And primarily startups. And if you're only looking at the modeling of risk in a single day or a single month or a single year and not looking at the long term, because when you put that on the Venn diagram or whatever it is you're using, it's an outlier so far out there that the chances of it happening,
you mean like a pandemic hitting?
Yeah, but if you went and looked at it and said the chances of this happening are like 1 in a billion, well, the chances of that happening could be 1 in a billion if though everyone you're doing business with is in the same field, right? Same startup and needs money, and all the assets that you've now invested in have this long-term return or diminishing return or negative return for the time being, you're in a scary situation. So I wanted to make sure we highlighted that part about SVB. They had all their eggs in one basket.
See, now, I'm gonna disagree with you there though, because I think even if they diversified their customer base, I don't think they would have changed anything. Mm-hmm. That if I was, say, I'm big oil, and for some reason I had money in that bank, and I see this snowball of everybody pulling out, me as being a good financial steward, I've got to follow suit. Mm-hmm. I have no choice at that point, because if I sit back and they become insolvent and I didn't try to get my money back, what's that make me look like? So I don't think it matters what vertical. Once that snowball is going, it's gone. You're not stopping it.
But the snowball was building much faster because the companies that were banking with them were pulling money out faster. Meaning, if let's say they did 50% of the people that held money in there were, say, the oil industry, et cetera, they still have X amount of money coming in. Most of these oil companies are still profitable right now. So they're actually putting more money back in than they are pulling out. Where the opposite is true for the tech startups, the burn rate from the tech industry. So if 90% of the customers you do business with have a very, very high burn rate, right? That's what sped this up. Like you look at it in the span of 2022, and this just comes from the previous company I work for. I mean, they grew over 100% last year, but had a super high burn rate. They laid off 10 to 15% of their company. And you're seeing that across all tech startups. Right. Even tech companies in general started doing layoffs because the burn rate to go through their special projects was too high for the return they want. They want fast return. Right. And that's the issue where I agree with you, Eric. It still could have happened, but it would have been you probably would have seen this then in June or July rather than say right at the beginning we're already in March, maybe August. But
you're talking about macro impacts of given verticals moving in the same direction because of some of the ratios that were going on. Because
a multiplying factor.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
So, and again, that's speculative on Brian, right? But I'm still looking at this from asking the questions why, right? If you ask why five times, get to the root cause. I'm not saying this gets us there, but I feel like it gets us closer. And like you said, as the water starts, as the tide goes out, what started to show its face, right, was a bunch of bad investments, negative, and now you have no cash back, you have no inventory, and the water's going out faster because, well, it's like Turnagain Arm up in Alaska, right? Like as the tide goes out, there was a pinch point, and that's because you, most of the companies you were working with, 90% of them were tech companies, pulling money out.
I struggle at some point that we've got to be careful on how much fear we introduce into potential risk, right? It can be very paralyzing. That it's almost like the Chicken Little thing, that how far do we go to cap risk versus how much do we actually continue to do our job?
Risk is real and risk is business. That's what we're here for.
I'm not saying it's not, but it's you're almost talking, you're playing an infinite game, right? There's infinite number of scenarios out there. And going into it, I would think that I mean, hindsight, we're playing Monday morning quarterback, right? It's very easy after the fact to look at all the numbers and go, well, you should have seen that coming. But up until that point, nobody saw it coming. And let's be honest, we've got some world-renowned experts that are looking at these type of things and didn't see this one coming.
Well, so I'm going to link to an article in the show notes from Financial Times 2 weeks ago. They saw it coming. It was actually a really prescient, when you go back and look.
It's too late.
Of course it's too late. But the other is, I want to restate my position that risk is real means risk is a real part of doing business, and we need, you can't run risk free. Yeah. What's the only secure computer? One that's locked, closed in a cabinet, turned off, wiped, no network connection, no power. Not real useful, is it? But it's risk free.
You heard it here, everybody. So Dan is actually advocating we go back to an abacus and let's.
No, quite the opposite. I'm saying that if you want to do anything in this world, it takes risk. There's risk stepping off the curb. Yeah, there's risk walking out of your house. All of that is risk. You can't, if you want to do anything, risk will be real. You just have to figure out where on that continuum you're comfortable. And this is the other thing that was interesting was there was no chief risk officer.
Yes, that's pertinent.
At SVB since 2022, since well through 2022, apparently. And I'll put the article that talks about that in there as well.
Just like everybody said back in early 2022, they're like, you work in tech? Oh man, that's gotta be the best life in the world. Or you work in security? Security never has a downturn, right? Like everybody believed that everything was so good. The roses were more than roses. They were roses.
And we certainly, and everyone alive today, no one alive today lived through 1999, 2007, and again. I mean, all of this stuff is cyclical. It's happening again. No one gets to use that excuse. No one gets to use that excuse. I appreciate you putting it out there, giving them their day in the sun, but that's not a valid excuse anymore.
So as I think back, so to the question that Brian, that you had asked me as what changes the way you look at companies, I think this is another inflection point that we need to look inside our companies. And I'm going to take a shot at business continuity plans. I think this is the Achilles heel of many organizations, that we've gone through the exercise of building BCPs, but that we've gone, okay, well, we'll contemplate being down for a day. But this is one of those scenarios that we need to, as things become more complicated, more interconnected, start planning much longer horizons. So in the case that, let's say 10 different tech companies in the security stack go away, we may have to take something offline because we no longer can protect it. And we need to fall back on a manual process, but knowing that a manual process, while that might be degraded services, is actually less impact to the organization than if I leave it online and we have a major security event, right? It's a risk trade-off at that point. So I really think this is an opportunity that we need to think through a lot of our BCPs.
So are we at a point, Eric, one of the defaults that happens in a lot of organizations is to say, we've got our stuff, we're using Amazon for all of our applications, for all of our hosting, et cetera. We're willing to accept the risk and therefore not plan for Amazon going away. Are we, and up to now, that's been generally, I hear it pretty consistently. Are we to a point where we need to look at even those large single points that have multiple redundancies within them and start to really honestly ask ourselves what happens if it goes away?
So the answer is yes. But I think it's easier to say from my perspective, from your perspective, from larger organizations that have the skill set, that have the capital to be able to look at a multi-cloud strategy or a multi-tool strategy. Mm-hmm. I think where this is really going to hurt is the small players in the game that don't have those options available to them.
Right.
But we've been ringing this bell for a while at the cloud services, right? That we've looked at the cloud from a business perspective and go, it's all in the cloud. It's safe. We don't have to worry about anything. This is Amazon's got more money coming in than the majority of countries around the world. Why would we be concerned about that? The fundamental answer is we do need to be concerned about that because it may not even be the insolvency of an Amazon, a Microsoft, or something like that. They may decide that they're going to go in a different direction that doesn't jive with how we're using their services, but we're beholden to them.
Right.
So I think the multi-cloud strategy and that, as it pertains to your question, I think has to be built into what we're doing.
And I threw it up there, the 10th man rule, as you were talking, Eric, that's exactly like what I have in the back of my head. Yeah. What, say that again?
10th person rule.
Yeah. The 10th person rule. Sorry. Especially during this month. But you look back at the movie World War Z, which used, you know, a movie to kind of indoctrinate the 10th person rule. And if everybody in the room agrees, then we need at least one person to disagree. It goes back to like when we talk about PFEMAs and DFEMAs, right? We look at all the risks, but what happens if this one thing fails? Yeah, but the chances of that happening are really small. Well, what's that percentage? But if that does, then how many other things fail, right? That leads up to a certain risk that's much larger, but you got to look at it in scale. It's like stack up tolerances.
Right,
yeah.
So I love the idea of that 10th person rule. If everybody in the room agrees that this is the best thing ever, one person needs to take the opposite and says, yeah, but what if, right? And I used to totally disagree with, well, you could come up with a million what ifs, right? But pick on this one. If everybody agrees, right, you need one person to disagree, state why, right, and what happens. And everybody in the room can say, well, the probability of that happening, it's like zero. It's like zero is different than zero.
The limit as X approaches infinity is not, it is zero, but the limit, it never hits zero. Yes.
Well, this right. is, so, I think it really highlights on going through the risk to organizations and kind of the structure, making sure that there's a good structure within the organization to start identifying some of those fringe risks. I mean, just looking at us, the way we do things is everything. So it's every vertical is represented within what we call our risk working group. And at the end of the year, there's a survey that comes out and everybody votes on kind of independent of everybody else on what they think the top risk to the organization is. And then everybody comes together and we have to debate until we get to the top 10. Right. So I think it's the bringing. So we talk about in the workplace about diversity of thought and all that. I think that's key in these scenarios and being able to play through all of these different scenarios. You do have to play the what if game. If we don't play the what if game, then our risk list never really changes. And then we miss things like this that are coming. And this is certainly, there are some lessons learned that we're going to have to take away from this.
It's a whole new class in business school being spun up over the weekend.
Yeah.
But going back to, do you look at, like, let's say you guys have a project, right? Could be identity access management, could be firewalls, could be securing OT, right? Do you look at it differently to say, hey, we have this OT project. Here's the four companies we're looking at. Two have been around for 10, 12 years, have a lot of experience, a little bit legacy. You know, this one here is 3 years old and only has A round funding. And this one here is, you know, C round funding, but those other two are both publicly traded companies. But if through the testing period, that one that only had A round funding really young showed amazing results and a proof of concept. And you're like, and their roadmap of where they're going is great. They don't have some of the legacy debt of these other ones, but based on what just happened with Silicon Valley Bank, do I take the risk of insolvency?
Yeah. But Brian, is that any different than if, you know, I'll come back to automotive because we never go to automotive, right? But we've been doing this with supply chain for the longest time. that if you look at an onboarding a new supplier, you're pulling D&B reports. You're looking at the financials of the organization, looking at what is the risk, what is the potential of them becoming insolvent or something happens where we have to either step in or they disappear as a supplier. So I think a lot of those controls have been in place.
Yeah.
Now, whether they've been being applied to technical vendors, different question. And maybe that's the opportunity as we start to grow and kind of the lesson learned that we look out of this, that we need that same level of scrutiny, not just to physical inputs, you know, kind of direct materials going into what we're building, but it's also got to look into our technology stack as well and the partners we're choosing there.
I'd also caution against using funding rounds as a litmus test, because I know many companies that are seed funded and have bootstrapped and grown themselves and are more stable than those that have taken on rounds. You know, there are people who take on and later in rounds, they overtake money and can't deliver, can't grow. That's why you see huge money growth and then layoffs. You know, there's all sorts of things. I don't think that's the funding level or funding maturity isn't necessarily the test I would use. I think I would look at overall financials, overall, you know, ability to pay, like Eric said, you know, D&B reports, things like that, that really give a more full picture of the organization rather than just Brian, you and I have lived in startup worlds. It's sexy stuff. It's stuff that's talked about and become the flash headlines, but it is not on its own a litmus test for the success or viability of a company.
Right. It's just one more metric in the totality of everything we're looking at.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go and say, Eric, I do agree with you on this, but I'm also going to say I disagree that the industry will start doing it more, meaning in the automotive manufacturing world, when you bring in a new supplier, there's a supplier risk management team. You could call it vendor risk management, but they're going back to look at your production risk. You know, what type of production control measures do you use? They're looking at your shipping, right? Like, what type of risk do we have? How far away are they from us? If they had a missed shipment, how long would it take us to get more parts? All those things go into supply chain in manufacturing. Now, on the tech side, are they going to start looking at, because they also look at the financials, you know, is this company underwater? Are they paying their vendors and their suppliers, right? Which means if they quit paying them, those companies aren't shipping them product, which means they can't build and ship to you. On the tech side, I noticed this, you know, in the last 2 years dealing with some of the big manufacturing companies here in the state of Michigan, they were asking more questions about your financials than a lot of the other companies or industries that I was doing business with, which means they were making it part of their process from a risk management of bringing on new vendors. What I don't see is all these other industries doing that same thing. It's just tech, right? Is kind of the feeling that I get, right? Like this isn't a finished good, right? There's from a supplier risk management standpoint, they weren't looking at the financials as much. So to your point, Eric, does that start to become more of the process, financial review being added into the vendor management or the supplier management team? And then are they able to manage that when now, you know, you had, you know, for any one automotive vehicle being built, you have 400 plus suppliers. Now in any one IT stack, you may have 400 plus vendors. That's a whole lot of additional processes to go through to validate tech companies.
Yeah. So will it be there in some element? I would suspect it will grow some of the scrutiny of some of the financials, but I'd also caution it because there's something in tech that is hard to solve for. And as you go back, so read Innovator's Dilemma, right? That if you talk about some of those entrenched giants, one of the biggest problems you have with entrenched giants is that they fail to innovate and then end up being the result of a market disruption and cease to exist. So there's other market dynamics that I think if we just purely look at financials that you would go, well, of course, I got to go for the tried and true. But there's another brewing risk that you probably cannot quantify. There's really no data that you're going to be able to pull around that. So I would caution back to what Dan was saying on a single metric kind of being the end all be all and how we're looking at things. It's a imperfect science, the way that we have to look at some of these organizations. Directionally correct.
And I think what becomes even a bigger concern than with what you just said would be the fact that large companies and large manufacturers have CFOs, have financial teams. So when these things, let's say come Monday morning, right, that you may have three vendors that are no longer in business or are reaching out because they may have trouble looming, right? And then the CFO goes back when this comes to financial risk and says, well, here's the things we need to be put in place, because if you're being ran by just the bookkeeping team, what's our risk model, right? Where then those things start being pushed down where you don't have the control as the tech expert at your company, the CIO, CTO, or CISO to say, well, the reason we do want to work with these companies is they're innovators, right? That technology changes rapidly, or how you can apply technology changes rapidly. And if you go with just the tested and true, the dinosaur, that tech may be obsolete a year or two from now because they're unwilling to change fast.
Right.
But I worry about, from a CFO standpoint, you know, they may put down rules to their team of who you can do business with, because at the end of the day, they're worried about dollars and cents. They report to the street, they report to a board, and that's what they care about.
Definitely going to be interesting.
Yeah, without question. It's going to be, I mean, the week ahead is, the week and the weeks ahead are going to be interesting, both from a tactical and a long-term perspective. You know, with this publishing on the Monday morning, right after this, what will be the first things you guys recommend for people to start to look at as they walk in the office and say, from a security practitioner or from a CIO perspective of how do we recover? How do we start to deal with this on Monday and then in 4 Mondays?
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I think the biggest risk that we'll see in the short term, we don't know how this is going to impact the viability of downstream companies yet. So I think we're going to sit back and wait on that one. I think in the short term, just like any event, and it's not unique to a bank becoming insolvent, the opportunistic leverage of a big news event used to try to con individuals into giving up money, right? I think that's still on the short run. That's got to be the narrative, and protecting against that, just making sure that, hey, we have controls in place for a reason. Do not circumvent those controls.
Eric, do you guys have any plans to like send out to all your vendors any type of sheet document that asks them like, hey, we just want to check in. You know, are you at any risk because of SVB? Were you doing banking with SVB? If so, and the reason I ask this question is from my days in automotive, anytime there was any type of world event, anytime there was a massive snowstorm, right, that shut down 2 states, or there's a hurricane, et cetera, any of our big OE customers, be it Toyota, GM, Volkswagen, would send out a thing to all of their suppliers and say, hey, we're reaching out. We need you to fill this out. We have identified you as a risk because you have manufacturing facilities located within this zone. What type of inventory do you have on hand? What is your risk to shipping, et cetera? Because they need to start planning for that week. Are we going to have any production hiccups, right? Now, do you do this where you send it out to any of your vendors to say, hey, we're just checking in. Are you at any risk because of SVB? And what I'm getting at too is, that's what we did in the automotive world. We had to fill those things out.
Yeah, I definitely think. I mean, your example kind of hits home on the natural disaster that could impact the flow of material into the overall supply chain. I think this one's a little bit tougher, right? Because it's organizations that don't necessarily have to disclose their financial impact. I think it'd be a little bit tougher to send those things out. Whether it happens or not, I would say that's probably more on the financial side of the house, that they're looking at that. What's the overall impact?
Yeah, well, I can tell
the security perspective.
Yeah, I can tell you that there is nothing I like less. I dread that tomorrow. Yeah. 50, 75, 100 emails, all written differently, asking a slightly different question, asking, are you affected by Log4j? Exactly. Yeah. and they all want a response immediately. And if you're not, then they're on you like stink on various things. And I think it's counterproductive. I understand it. It's rooted. I'm going to play the counterpoint in this, but I think it's counterproductive because what it is it means I have to take resources to answer you away from determining our impact on this. Now, in the financial piece, this is something a little different, but again, back to Log4j or something where I literally got 70 that morning from various companies and asking what that, you know, whether were we vulnerable. And I get it. But I'd also ask for 10 minutes to be able to figure out the answer, because the answers were yes or no, not I'm still figuring it out because I learned about this 10 minutes ago, just like you did.
And in all honesty, though, I think this is one of those easier ones from an internal perspective to be able to deduce what the actual risk is.
Yeah.
We know the banks that we're paying for all of these different vendors. We could quickly go through our vendor list and go, all right, do we have anybody we're paying through Silicon Valley Bank?
I disagree because I think that assumes that the bank you pay into is the bank you carry all your money in.
Sure,
and that's not the case. You know, especially back to Brian's don't put all your eggs in one basket parable that started the show off, you know, from the beginning. The wise company will have their money in various different places. And just because I'm not, I mean, it's a good place to start, don't get me wrong, but it's not the be all end all list. So then the question is, do you then have to ask them all anyway? The other thing I want to go to is, please, if I need to, I'll go to the wide cam again and be the old crotchety guy and tell a story or plea, but please, vendors. Tomorrow, I don't want to see any emails from you telling us how your product is immune or your company is immune to these kinds of financial things. You do, you get blocked. You're done. You're gone. I'm not going to talk to you again. I will add Eric back on the screen here. And we will both tell you humbly and loudly, do that and you're gone. This is not, you know, do not use the crisis of the day to try and sell us on your thing. That's not what we need to see.
I've gotten pretty good at blocking email domains pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. So I predict that will be Monday morning as well. Let's see if that comes true, or maybe the word will get out and they'll learn this time. But I suspect perhaps not.
Yeah, Soapbox, take that another extent, and other actual security events and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Stop posting about how you're the silver bullet and you would have stopped it. You have no clue.
Yeah.
So you're saying that I shouldn't add into any of my presentation decks a slide that shows we banked with five different companies and only had 5% in SVP. We have a lot of really smart people on our team, which makes our tech really awesome. Like, that slide I should take out.
Yes.
And I'll, the fact that I wasn't banking with them as some type of parallel that we have really smart tech guys. That's why our product is awesome. I should remove that one.
And we employ an article with the crystal ball that knew they were going to go under, so we didn't bank with them.
And I'll close. Go ahead.
No, Dan, this is a sidebar question, but do you think there is any direct correlation to SVB and the price of eggs right now on the market? Because the price of eggs have just increased dramatically.
Had you looked 3 weeks ago, you would have been able to see that as interest rates rise, egg production rates lower. Chickens are very sensitive to the markets. They're very tied into the markets, and their yields, you know, the yield of a bond is actually directly linked to the yield of a chicken. So yes.
Correlation is causation.
That's right.
I mean, I was like, man, with everyone putting all their eggs in one basket and then trying to pull all their eggs out, is there a correlation to the real egg price increasing?
And think about how much all the eggs in that basket really do cost now. I'm going to close us off with a story. When I lived in Chicago, yes, there are other states than Michigan. Those of you that listen may not realize that we know that, but there are.
Chicago's a state?
Well, yes, there's Chicago and then there's the rest of Illinois. They really are different things. When living in Chicago, and working in the city, there was a favorite restaurant of mine. And that restaurant would every few months get red tagged for health violations. But it was delicious. And the day after they reopened from those red tag violations, I walked straight in and I would get food. You know why? Because that restaurant was never cleaner than when they reopened. And I think for banks like this, for systems like this, these things happen. It's not great. The resulting outcome of where SVB lands and their assets land, somebody might buy the whole thing off the FDIC. Everything, it might be that this is the cleanest place to eat after they reopen because they've had inspections, they've had understanding, they've had a wake-up call. But at the same time, it may also fall back into old habits. And so the point is, nothing can get written off right on the surface. And the day after somebody comes back from a red tag, go eat at the restaurant because, boy, it's probably delicious and clean for at least that day. Thanks so much for joining us today. Thank you, Brian. And thank you, Eric. It's always a pleasure having this great discussion. And thanks to you, the listener. We really love having you as part of this, and we love your feedback. You can contact us on our email, feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. You can find all of our episodes on our website, www.greatsecuritydebate.net. We are on the YouTubes at Great Security Debate, youtube.com/@greatsecuritydebate. We're also on the dying Twitter, at Security Debate. We'll see how long that lasts. Maybe next time we can talk about how much API access is worth, because it sounds like $200,000 a year might be the going rate for access to that data. And you can find all of our podcasts on your favorite podcast application. So go listen, tell a friend. We'd love to see more feedback from all of you. We'd love to hear your ideas for future show ideas. Thanks again, and we'll see you again on the next Great Security Debate.